I think because we're going to start shortly with a discussion between the panelists and then open it up to a few prime suspects. I have a question because we've been going through so many different discourses and kind of overlapping languages of theory and critique, that if there are some terms that need to be clarified, maybe without a microphone and not as questions, if those could just be shouted out and we can clarify those. So maybe if there's some terminology that was unclear or needs a further clarification, then...
Post-Westphalian.
Post-Westphalian, okay. That's for you guys. Any more? Okay, and please do use the microphones, because I really, at this point, I should say, if you look up in that little room, there's some translators working very hard to make this accessible to everybody, so thank you so much. So, post-Westphalian, got it?
All right, am I going to take this one? Is this working? Okay, briefly, is it actually Bratton's idea, or was that?
No, it's a term that's been...
Okay, I mean, Westphalia is the establishment of the modern nation state. Post-Westphalia, I suppose, is a way of trying to think a lot of the things that are happening beyond borders and how to think about what the state might now be. I mean, is that sound right by you as well? Do you want to add to that?
Hello. Good. Yeah. I would just say that it's sorry. Who asked? Because I feel badly. I'm not looking. Oh. obviously it's like using the post term, so it's not actually defining. But I think it just is sort of indexing this the way that certain how would I describe it? The traditional sort of role that the state. How am I going to tackle this one?
But it refers to the peace of West.
Yes, exactly.
30 years more.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So the establishment of like...
Yeah.
Right, and so I mean, what I think is kind of interesting for that, sorry, I'm a bit slow today, no sleep, is what was interesting to me about this was that it's basically some sort of... it's a kind of global way to divide up space, right? That was a kind of consensus of how this would function. It served a certain purpose, and now we can see that due to other infrastructures and other modes of organizing bodies in space, that perhaps these structures are no longer as, I wouldn't say valid, but I would say that these sort of supports of a way to divide up space and organize bodies in that space need to be, in the very least, reformed. But I think to index this term, to use it as a kind of post-Westphalian, which is obviously not actually making the next step to define what that new structure would be, it's still in this kind of tentative space. So I'd say this kind of term more indexes the acknowledgement that there is one structure. I mean, Bratton uses this metaphor of a stack versus the kind of like 2D border space that was like typically used by the nation state. So something to this effect.
And that's great, because I would like to start to jump kind of immediately into something where, I mean, there's a lot of disparate positions to try and tie together here, or to at least fight over. Because one thing that, Evgeny, you mentioned the smart city, and you looked at the city as the contested spaces of the future, and I sort of wonder how that sort of jives with the politics of alienation, or a sort of more global perspective on where, even this impotence, where will these sort of, let's say, potential uprisings or this potential space spaces, and how does this relate to exactly this sort of notion of, like, how do you locate this, like, time, labor, and value in a geopolitical space? Because one thing I would kind of question is, first to you, is how does, what do you think about a not European locations and like other sites of resistance, but also how do you see that happening? How do you see these politics of the smart city getting played out in rural environments?
Is it on? Well, let me sort of start from far away and move into the question. I don't think it's correct to say that the city is the site of future resistance. I mean, the city primarily the site also of past resistance. I mean, this is where resistance to capitalism has taken place, whether it has been in the form of strikes or in the form of demonstrations or in the form of any other urban contestation. I don't think that that's going away anytime soon. And we have actually seen something of a resurgence of that form of protest over the last 5-7 years, with protests erupting everywhere from Brazil to Turkey to Spain to now France. So that will continue for reasons that, you know, we can debate, and I think David Harvey actually points out really well when he talks about the shift towards the anyhow, the shift towards the politics of the capture of value, right, and realization of value, that it's now also an essential part for capitalism to be able to not just exploit the worker in the factory, which is no longer actually possible with the automation of work and the shift of productive facilities to Asia, Africa, and elsewhere, Latin America, but it's also important to capture some of those rents as citizens, workers enter social relations in the city. So, you know, this is why we are increasingly paying more for rent, but also for all sorts of other services, starting from your internet bill to your water bill to your gas bill to whatever. So, I mean, that clearly triggers a lot of protests, including the protests we have seen in Brazil, for example, over increased public transportation costs. That said, I think it's, and this is something where I think I would like to respond to what Bifo has said with regards to the eruption of some kind of cognitarian revolt. I think it's has been a tendency within certain theoretical strands of Italian Marxism and other types of Marxism to expect that the transition to service work and knowledge work will result in precisely that kind of revolt. Right? And actually, just to practice my Italian, I pulled up a book by Bifo from 1978, Il cielo è caduto sulla terra, which makes exactly the same quasi-religious expectation that cognitariat revolt will happen, only that then we were still limited to the paradigm of the factory. I mean, the reality is that in the 30 years that have passed, if not more, that did not happen. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. And I would argue that actually Silicon Valley, which we can debate to what extent it's an interesting or even a useful analytical framework to think about those issues. But the reality is that these are the guys right now who are in the avant-garde of pushing for basic income. I mean, they are the people who fully expect somebody else, hopefully the state, to pick up the bill for paying for post-work, post-capitalist reality, while they will continue getting us screwed up in one way or another through higher rents that we'll have to pay for access to everything else. And this is where I think it's very important to understand that the smart city is a paradigm of basically metered access. This is what it is. You know, when you go, I don't know, you probably see it in Europe, when you go to the US, you see it really well. When you go to London, you know, you get on London Underground, the Oyster card is the paradigm of what's going to happen. You're going to have metered access for virtually everything else that you're using in the city, and that will be a way in which all sorts of efficiency, or so they will claim, will be introduced into the production and organization of everyday life. This is where I think there is another new front that is opening that might actually be far more exciting in terms of opening up spaces for contestation than even work or post-work, and that would be the politics of data. And that will be us drawing a connection between the ways in which data at this point, combined with other types of infrastructure, some of it for machine learning, some of that for analytics, some of that for data sharing, will be key to any kind of self-organization and self-management of communities on a local, regional, national, or whatever level you would like to imagine. If you really want to have fully modern, technologically based, self-organized communities, you will need to be able to collect, run, and own your own data. along with the rest of the infrastructure, because clearly the rest of the infrastructure will be as important as the data one. And this is where I think there is a possibility to open a new front, not unlike the front that we have had way back when what was contested was the ownership of land. And I'm absolutely, like, it's not, you know, I'm not making a sort of a metaphor here. I think this is what the frontier should be. In that sense, I do think that it is important to also think beyond the kinds of struggles that can take place outside just of the riot that has failed to materialize within the knowledge economy itself. We can continue hoping that it happens, but we have seen that the linguistically and intellectually constant cooptation of flexibility, autonomy, creativity, neoliberals are just, we are good at that. And that has happened with, you know, first the discourse of hacking, now it has happening with the discourse of the sharing economy. There is very, it's very hard. The hipsters, you know, you can kind of go and add to that list. I don't think that that game can be won, to be honest. What can be won is politicization of data and its ownership, and then trying to understand how being completely estranged and alienated from that data will, in fact, lead to some kind of hyper-modern feudalism, whereby you will have to pay for access to virtually anything that was previously a shared commodity or resource in your city or in your community.
Well, thank you. So maybe I would go with you, Bifo, and then ask maybe if you want to respond to that, no? Yeah, and then both of you. And I do, like, we don't have so much time, so I urge everybody to be as concise as possible.
In that case, I would like to answer. I want to answer to what Eugenie says, because it's so important, in my opinion. I mean, it's this is the, in my opinion, the strategical issue that we have to focus on and to elaborate. I mean, in terms of think to Lenin. Lenin coming back from Finland, and I'm not a Leninist. I've never been a Leninist. I think that the Soviet Revolution has been the most stupid mistake of the 20th century, putting the history of the century on the wrong way, but I think that the Leninist tactical ability has to be, and what does he do? Is Lenin going to speak with 100 million farmers in the countryside of Russia at all? He speaks with 5,000 metal workers of the Putilov and some hundreds of soldiers here and there, more. And so maybe, but a small minority which can do the job. That is my tactical starting point. And I also draw the lesson of 15 years of no global movement and of Occupy movement. An extraordinary experience, hundreds of extraordinary experiences leading to nothing. I mean, we have not won one single fight in the last 15 years. We have not stopped one single measure of the financial class in Europe and in the world. So, should I conclude that it's over? We should not demonstrate in the street. We should demonstrate in the streets, yes, and going on to do useless things like crying and so on. Why? Because this is the only way to reactivate the body of the general intellect, the political intelligence, the political understanding and the political sentiment of those few people who have something, who can be effective. I think that the problem, you know, think to the last 15 years. So what is the only action that has been effective? WikiLeaks, Julian Assange and some friends that we can like or dislike, but who have had the ability not of disclosing things that I already knew that the American military killed civilians. I did not need WikiLeaks. But they have exposed the ability of Cognitarians to create a network of solidarity and to dismantle and possibly tomorrow to reprogram the global machine. This is the only way out. This is not happening anytime soon. Let's wait. Maybe it will never happen. But I don't see any other way for the future.
Just to kind of add into this point, because it is more of like my own problem, and I think one that you were hinting at in a very polite way towards what we had said before, and this was this kind of doubt about this kind of overemphasis on reason, for example. And the one thing that I know that I am deeply troubled by, even though recognizing that obviously like purely affective solutions to certain problems that we have are you can't will climate change away, right? Like there needs to be some sort of other, you know, scientific emotional program that goes with it. That said, what is very dissatisfying about what has become like a neo-rationalist turn, or if you want to talk about reason or something like this, is this kind of direct linkage between knowing and action. And the thing so I'm a bit confused because I know I can't reconcile that, right? I mean, I think that, and so the obvious answer is not to say that, oh, well, it's, you know, behavior of people is just like random and so on and so forth. No, we need to be informed. But I guess my difficulty is like in a neo-rationalist critique, I hear this sort of thing, you know, this phenomena exists, but then WikiLeaks gets celebrated as like the information is there and then we can act on it. But I really think this linkage between the knowing and the behavior needs to be properly understood, because it seems to me that actually we're in this kind of moment of disavowal, for example. And so how do you overcome that disavowal? Like that you know it and you do something different. You know something better, but you do it anyways, right? Like you said, you knew all this stuff was happening. Now it's just sort of proof. But does this kind of change behavior? So how, like, I guess I'm asking if anyone here has a more sort of direct theorization of this linkage now, of how this information actually, you know, is fundamentally changing human behavior, which happens on, you know, like both an epistemic and emotional level. So,
I think Bifo, do you want to take that?
Shortly. You know, the point is, you speak of the environmental issue, for instance, which is, I mean, let's be frank, there is no way out. We are dealing with irreversible trends. We know that the effects of oil pollution, for instance, are coming down in the next 20 years. The effects of this, so no way out except if those who have created and invented the machine have the ability to find something able to dismantle the effects of the machine. Only being inside the machine that has created the mess, we can dismantle the mess. You rightly say that there is a problem which is not a problem of information, not a problem of knowledge, but a problem of emotion, of the emotional body I totally agree, and I think that the problem of Silicon Valley is an emotional problem. It's the problem that suicide has increased of 60% in the last 30 years, and this is an effect of the digitalization of life and of the loss, the dissolution of the bodily relation between human beings linked with the neoliberal prison of competition, the suicide, depression. This is the starting point of what I call the reactivation of the body of the general intellect. We need to march in the street, not because this is useful, it's useless, but it is very useful because it is the only way to reactivate the body of the general intellect.
Now, see, this is something I'd like to bring this back, because I think if we, like, I like that, of course, ownership and, like, maintenance, or let's say some kind of control of the infrastructures and data is important. But what I see, and especially when you look at a sort of libertarian, very much coming from this, like, a very... basically a belief in the quantified society, that already an apolitical stance that already, and like when you have a really quite apolitical or depoliticized sets of like knowledge and practices and people that are in positions to take control of the politics of data. So you have an, do you see what I'm saying? Is that how do you relate that to this basically completely useless, like but necessary going into the streets, which I actually think is the kind of alienation that you're talking about. Do you see what I'm mean?
I hope. Well, I mean, look, I agree with Bifo on the need to have collective experiences that can then generate some kind of shared meaning space or horizon, if you want to put it that way. Where I think I disagree is an actual reading or interpretation of events that have led us to where we are right now. So if you look at something, I mean, like WikiLeaks, to get back to the example, I mean, in a sense, it's a failure of trying to work on a model where you actually do try to integrate the general intellect into the operations of the platform. Because if you look at its transition from a site which actually wanted to have people who will come in and sort of write annotations to the documents, to sort of generating media reports out of them, Julian Assange, in the first 2 or 3 years of its existence, quickly realized that this just doesn't work and it doesn't happen. So he had to take the reins of editorial control into his own hands and start making partnerships with established media organizations, which was the only way to bring attention to any of those documents. Because by themselves, you can keep dumping them online, but unfortunately, there are still a lot of barriers in terms of creating and generating attention around a lot of those materials. So this is where you actually do need a strong, centralized, one-man kind of operation. But another point to keep in mind is that, I mean, right now, what keeps that project going is not the collective efforts of the general intellect, it's the benevolence of the Ecuadorian government, which might be voted out of office as early as next year. And I think we have to keep that in mind as well, that, you know, there are still powerful state-led actors and institutions that, you know, might be conducive to the emergence of the general intellect, and I don't want to deny that, you know, in the case of something like TTIP, WikiLeaks has primarily been responsible for the emergence of a global public opposed to that treaty. It's partly thanks to the drafts of the treaty that were leaked to WikiLeaks and then distributed online that that public has come into being. Ultimately, you know, it's tied to that leaking infrastructure. So, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, there is a lot of truth to the narrative that Bifo, I think, is putting, but we also have to understand that on many issues, the story is a bit is a bit more old school, so to say, right? And with regards to how can we connect all of that to actual acts of contestation, right, and protest with regards to data and everything else, I think, look, ultimately, the problem here is not at the level of algorithms or data or cybernetics, for that matter. I think the problem here is that except for a few places in Latin America and Southern Europe, in much of Northern Europe and Western Europe, and let alone North America, there has been a reluctance to reopen questions of ownership and questions of what kind of non-market forms are actually allowed to exist and coexist inside our own citizen communities, right? And this is the reason why I think the default assumption on all things connected to information, digital technologies, and so forth, is that they cannot even be imagined as some kind of a non-market good. And this is where I think there has been a tremendous failure, not so much of the digital imagination, but of the non-neoliberal imagination to articulate the kinds of ownership forms, which, you know, there is, of course, the ongoing talk about the common, a lot of it happening in Italy, but how exactly would that work with regards to data? I mean, what would a non-neoliberal alternative to Google look like? And I would argue that it would not look like another search engine with a European flag on it. We are talking about a radically different system which will not just feature a different logo, but it will not even be a search engine in itself. You know, it might be that we have overestimated the need and the utility of embracing some kind of globalist vision of a global village of the 1990s, which all of us linked with cyberspace and the internet, which has proved far more advantageous to the needs of global capital than of the non-existing global village, which means that, you know, it is possible that a lot of our information needs, as we transition to some kind of non-neoliberal future, will actually be satisfied by much smaller, decentralized, localized information initiatives, and will only be satisfied by one giant centralized monopoly out of Mountain View. Right? But we need to imagine those forms, and we need to imagine what kind of legal regimes, for example, we need to put in place around data so that it's not sucked out and put in this data reservoirs where it's kept forever while we are being converted into some kind of dependent, feudal subjects to a bunch of companies who have sucked all of it in.
No, I think Diane, you wanted to...
I mean, I agree with you on this idea of that it needs to get to a point where we try to understand what a non-neoliberal sort of version of this would look like. And I one of the things I wanted to ask you about was like where you think the state is, and sort of trying to the idea of like constructing a society that has responsibilities to its citizens. Like, is that just completely out the window? And then also this idea of like protesting, like really, it's like if. Okay, protesting doesn't work. I'm with you on that. It's not an effective tactic for political change, or so it seems. So, okay, if people want to do it to make themselves feel better, that's fine. There's lots of other ways you can make yourself feel better. But, you know, then the operations are just left to carry on. And that seems completely insufficient if, you know, if you're actually wanting to... construct something. So I guess, I mean, it's both, I suppose I have both a question and a statement you said something during your talk about regulation being sort of out the window, and I wanted to sort of ask you about that. Like, why is that completely out the window? Like, why is that like a, why do we have to forget that? Is there, and where is the role of the state in all of this? Like, have we given up on the state as a model? Whether it be like nation states as they exist, or the possibility of, given things like what happened through the Panama Papers, and seeing the fact that like transnational finance sort of functions very happily, thank you very much, would there not be a way of at least thinking about a global taxation? So something like health care provision could be provided on an international basis, sort of contributed by a partial contributions internationally. And also climate change would be another thing. You know, I mean, we were talking about this last night. I mean, this happens already through charity, but would there be a way to establish some sort of obligatory sort of payment based on, I don't know, GDP or something like this? So are we really sort of just taking the role of what states have been and responsibilities to citizens and like saying, forget it, like that's no longer viable because of this sort of like atomization of the individual and sort of everything coming down to micropayments, which I agree. I mean, it sounds like a disaster. So like, you know, listen, in and of itself, I mean, if it's just that, I mean, because then it's like everyone's just like left to their own devices. So I guess I'm just wondering where... is there not space to start to think about what kind of society we would want, how we would have responsibilities to citizens, and how that would be constructed? If we think protesting isn't viable, if we recognize sort of systems in place through current technology.
So on the question of the state and the regulation, I mean, I think that in the short term, and if we start with a very kind of localistic view of what's happening, you know, any effort to contain the spread, and I think here we should just be talking about a new form of highly informationalized and financialized capitalism, which, you know, for the sake of convenience, I call Silicon Valley, but, you know, that's what essentially it stands for, right? And the only way to contain it in the short term on a local level would probably be regulation. But that would not be regulation of the kind whereby, you know, you're trying to maintain and protect the interests of the local taxi industry or the local hotel industry. I mean, it would probably be of the kind where you go and you actually radically demand from Airbnb to start sharing the data as the very first measure with the city about what on earth they're doing with the apartments that they're putting on the market in the city. Because that's the only way to actually understand whether their claims that they're working primarily in the interests of the working class and the people who just have a spare room are actually correct, or whether the claims of their opponents that they actually are in bed with giant real estate, globalized financial investors who have bought hundreds of apartments in every city and are now putting them up on Airbnb actually correct. There is no way to answer that question empirically unless the city establishes its sovereignty over that data. So, I mean, those kinds of interventions, I think, are possible, and they have taken place in some cities, you know, even neoliberal cities. Amsterdam, by no means, you know, the socialist utopia of 1960s, you know, now Amsterdam is at the front of neoliberal transformation. They managed to get that data, in part because even there the officials understand that their authority will be undermined if they do not have that data. That's the first point. But I think here, once you start moving out of the local to the national and to the European, if you're talking about Europe, you'll immediately run into problems that I would argue will be far greater than the problems that, you know, Greece and Syriza ran into when they tried to challenge the financial hegemony. There is also a technological hegemony in Europe. There is a certain path which revolves primarily around making the ties with transatlantic partners closer and closer, increasing the free circulation of data, but doing it in a way that would not immediately harm the interests of domestic industry, mostly in Germany. So we have to liberalize as much as we can, basically without developing any robust domestic alternatives to Silicon Valley, but in a way that will not immediately hit the car companies, the banks, and the publishers. And you can see then how it gets translated into specific funding programs, Horizon 2020, what European Commission does, what's happening at the level of lobbyists. You can go and actually trace it down, and WikiLeaks has been quite good in revealing some of those documents as well. To challenge that on a local level is impossible. To challenge that on a national level would be also extremely hard. The first step to getting there is at least to start problematizing this issue so that we know that it's not just Wall Street and it's not just financial capital that we have to be afraid of. But I would argue that the key here, probably at this point in Europe, at least, still resides at the level of the city. The problem is that once Google comes and they tell you, we'll fix your transport, we'll fix your parking, we'll fix your utility management, we'll fix your waste collection, which they already do to many cities, you cannot come up with a bottom-up alternative to them in an easy manner because your own budget is already depleted because everybody is living under conditions of austerity. So the only way there would be trying to link up the efforts of cities and finding out alliances between, you know, Madrid, Barcelona, and some other, you know, non-neoliberal city in Europe, Naples, maybe. It's a very hard thing to find these days. But you will not be able to do it on a city-to-city kind of manner. So there are things that can be done. I can go on for another hour trying to bring the theory of the state into it, but I would argue that I would rather start with existing conditions in Europe, where it is vis-a-vis America at this point, and try to work from there rather than start from the theory of the state and then try to articulate, you know, how we can actually bring in some reasonable regulation. Because ultimately, most of the doors are already closed and they're not going to get open.
Okay.
just quickly, I mean, that sort of seems to be already the problem. It's like the trajectory is sort of like already going, and so it's like, well, fuck, all right. that just seems like, is that all we're left with? Because it is to carry on with this trajectory. I mean, I take your point about taking existing realities. I mean, but I think to floor close on the imagination, the leaps of imagination that might be necessary to at least entertain some possibilities beyond these local conditions. So.
I'm really sorry, because we do, one of the things we don't have a tremendous amount of is time here. I'm going to open this up, and I would first like to look, it looks like Eva Majewska, who's also been one of the expert tour guides in the Nervous Systems exhibition, maybe we can get a microphone. You wanted, I think you had a comment. And Hito, it looked like you wanted to say something, so your eyebrows had questions in them.
Thank you for the microphone, and thank you very much for all these discussions and presentations. I was thinking very much, because I felt for quite a large part of time being here, that there is this one common thing that you all shared, although the talks were very different and also appearing in very different discursive theoretical fields. But still, there was one thing that I particularly enjoyed, and I would like to thank you for it, which was a sort of sense of nonconformity. So each and every one of you had a very decent portion of it in some way, and this is something very refreshing on this beautiful day. But anyways, going back to the politics, your discussion that you just had here somehow was missing one very important social or political agent, which is the public. So for some reason you were jumping between, and this was something which awoke my nonconformity, if I may say, because to me this is, the body of the public, of the general intellect, was like the closest you guys got there. But somehow there is a constant ping pong between the state, the neoliberals, as you call them, and the individuals. And I want out of individuals, basically. I really want out, because we've been there for too long, basically. And the neoliberal political agenda requires us thinking in this badly alienated way, so as opposed to the highly creative alienation that you are suggesting, this super alienated way of thinking of humans who are apparently non-related to each other, non-contextualized, non-embodied, etc. This, I think, in our political resistance today is perhaps the biggest obstacle, actually. Perhaps even bigger than the extraction of value as it happens today, as it happened before. So I would ask about one thing. I would ask about your visions of public, if you have any, or if you think it's my intervention is necessary. Any comments on that? Or possibly also on avant-garde, because for some reason I see these two somehow connected, but that's my idiosyncrasy. So, and thank you very much again.
Okay, I think we're going to start with Bifo on this.
No, they're avant-garde, she said. No, I missed the...
You missed the question? Can you repeat? The question.
Avant-garde.
So I am.
So we can choose, basically. You get to choose between the public and avant-garde.
Before I'm going to give the first response, and we'll go to Yevgeny and then to...
No, well, I really don't want to go on a sort of polemic or discussion. It's very important, in my opinion, that the problem is on the table. In my opinion, this is the subject that we will be talking about in the next period. I mean, can we start to go beyond the neoliberal agenda, and can we start a process of political reappropriation of one? I say no. There is no neoliberal agenda. The neoliberal word is not the effect of an agenda, of a political will. It's the deployment of a techno-linguistic paradigm. And the only way out is the constructing the techno-linguistic paradigm that we call neoliberalism, or better, absolute capitalism. In this way, I agree with the idea that the level is the individual level. If we can say individual, not in the sense that individually we can come out from the trap, but because it's at the level of, I would not say individual, I would say at the level of singularity, of the painful, the suffering singularity, the suffering singularity of those people who have created, who are managing the techno-linguistic machine, and who are the only people that can dismantle and reprogram the techno-linguistic machine. I don't want to insist. I am happy that we are starting at last the real strategic discussion.
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons why the people are invisible is because, you know, what Tariq Ali calls the extreme center has sucked out all the life out of political arena in much of Europe and North America, which means that, you know, in Germany, you know this phenomenon really well, where the extreme center at this point will probably refer to an endless coalition between parties that do not really differ much from each other, which also explains why, you know, the biggest issues of campaigns in many European countries, but also now in the United States, is the conflict between the elites and some kind of upsurging challengers to the status quo. On that logic, I would actually disagree with Bifo, and I would argue that, you know, under these conditions, to vote for Donald Trump in the United States, if you're a Republican, might be the most rational thing to do. If that alternative are people like Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush, and you clearly understand that something is roaring in the country and that the elites are more or less have completely lost the plot, what do you do? You vote for the guy who promises to upsurge the elites, while at the same time having something of a completely isolationist, anti-trade position on many other issues, which actually is quite favorable to the interest of the working class. But I don't want to focus on the United States. You see the same kind of rupture happening elsewhere in Europe, be that, you know, Spain, or be that now in France. You know, the Italian situation with the five-star movement is a bit more complicated. But there is this eruption, right? And I think that it has happened in some countries, and you know, in Germany, I don't see that happening. And you know, the rupture that's happening is happening from the extreme right, without necessarily putting the interests of citizens into the same rhetorical package as you have seen in Spain with Podemos, or you're seeing now with L'Ennui Debout in Paris, or that you're even seeing somewhat with the Five Star Movement in Italy. But I think that that will come, or you know, that, to me, is the main barrier that stands to the greater visibility of the interests of citizens in all of the current battles. I mean, the political the system of representative democracy in Europe, in North America, no longer delivers, and it hasn't been delivering for a long time, which also accounts for the complete dissatisfaction with the political process and falling rates of participation in anything from referenda to elections.
You know what, I have to, like, maybe I will interject just shortly, and I'm going to speak then for the entire city of Berlin. And I'm going to say that, A, I don't think protest culture is dead and or ineffective. I think political culture actually is something that one has to understand. The types of, like, mobilizations that do not have a political form and or intention are not the same, right? And that's, I think that's a huge misunderstanding, that people going to the streets when there's not a political, like, agency and intention that's organized, that's something different. And that, for example, the refugee struggle here has gained tremendous ground in terms of how, like, people that are undocumented in Germany, their basic daily lives have been changed tremendously for the better due to waves and waves of demonstrations. And it's similar to the anti-gentrification movement, which has gained major concessions from large land building owners. And again, like, I have to talk about, like, the Tempelhof, public vote, which actually got rid of the mayor, like, a couple of years ago. So these are massive manifestations, but there's a lot of political organization that goes on behind them. And I would say protest culture is alive and well, at least in Berlin, and it's certainly having major impacts on how people live their lives here. And I'm sorry, I just have to say that, because if I hear these things, it's that certainly plays a role, but people's lives do change through these things.
Absolutely. I think one of the problems is we're speaking in such simplifications here. Local, global, this works, this doesn't work. This is precisely the binary problem that really needs to stop, and we need to have nuance, because when I hear this local pitted against the global, everything's embedded in everything else. And I think this is precisely, I mean, I don't have such a clear answer, but I think this could be deeply addressed to your question of where's the public? Because how are we to move from this condition of total atomization to the type of scale that we know we kind of need to reach without having a theory of the transits between these states? So I don't think it's so easy to just say Google, big global corporation versus local thing. It's like, how do those localities and the proliferation of them find a gluing mechanism, find a theory of this kind of, I don't know, I like this, I mean, it's, yeah. Anyways, find a kind of theory to glue these things together, how to make it operational, but clearly not pitting one against the other, because I think this kind of binarization doesn't really get us anywhere.
Okay, I think we have time for last words from each of the panelists, and then we'll have to actually, we really do have to thank our translators, because this is why we have to stick to our timeline. They've done a wonderful job, and but you can imagine it's not that easy. So we're going to start with last words and just do that, and then we'll be out of this room.
Sure. No, I would actually insist on the importance of talking about local and global for the sole reason that from a purely logistical viewpoint, you know, when you're talking about local physical infrastructure that you can either block, occupy, or take over, it lends itself to a very different repertoire of political action. When you're talking about something like Google, which comes and invades your city through a mobile app over which you have very little control of the city or the citizen as a community, there is nowhere to go on strike, there is, you know, no clout to take hostage, I think it is actually important. You don't have to use the word global if you don't want to, but, you know, there is an important differentiation here in terms of how services are provided. It just used to be that with gas, energy, electricity, and many other services, you are tied to physical flows in a way that you can block them. I don't want to give the impression that somehow there is an immaterial dimension to information and, you know, it's not true. Clearly, there is a material dimension, but it's just much harder. Like, and this is why I would say we are now talking about infrastructure that acts, walks, and talks like the financial infrastructure of Wall Street rather than the previous physical infrastructure of gas, waste management, or whatever else. And this is what something like the smart city is. It's the transition to infrastructure that resides somewhere else that you have very little control over. And this is why I think it is actually not so problematic to be using words like local and global to differentiate between the two, if only from a purely operational viewpoint of how easy it is to disrupt its flows.
Just one point on that. Is this idea that maybe it doesn't necessarily have to be just one...
I'm sorry, you know what? We're asking for final comments
okay,
now.
Fine,
I'm sorry. That's
a particular closing...
No, sure. There's a distinction, and that's important. I think the Timothy Mitchell book, Carbon Democracy, was a pretty like serious historical analysis of exactly the sort of things that you're mentioning. How in certain conditions of energy production, that these sorts of modes of resistance could gain some sort of power, right? Like a coal miner was a highly laborious thing. You could block train tracks. It's a vastly different operation when there's a new energy paradigm. So I agree with you. I think it's about figuring out, you know, where those sites are, those strategic sites are. So in this, we're on agreement. I think the issue that I have is more to think about this trend, to think the local and the global more in this transitory sort of relationship, rather than this kind of, this is it. Because then it's like, okay, what is the threshold of definition for locality? What's the threshold of definition? I mean, it just gets very blurry. So I think it's actually more productive to kind of think about these transits rather than trying to impose these sort of strict, regimented categories around it.
Well, nothing smart comes to my mind, you know.
You're like so fish.
Yeah, I'm like fish.
So just a quick thanks to all the panelists and everybody and Hakave and the translators. And yeah, let's enjoy what's left of the sun.